Rome. And some have asked me, well, why are you preaching these things that are history? And I mean, there's a number of Bible passages that help us to understand why. But that is the reason, is that these are things that help us to understand. You may remember that Paul was in prison once in Rome. The first time, he was allowed to stay in his own private house. And anybody who wanted to come in could see him. Anybody, they could bring food, they could bring money, they could whatever. But a few years later, after he was released, and then a year or so later, he was imprisoned again. And this time, it wasn't in that kind of arrangement. And ultimately, he was killed there. And so this is Rome. On the one hand, all happy, all kinds of pagan celebrations, but look what they're doing to the Christians. And so we want to talk about it. And we're going to begin in the book of Romans. And we know that it was written by Paul. In chapter 1, verse 1, he says very plainly, Paul, an apostle. It was written, we believe, approximately 57 to 58. If you want to go to Romans, to the first chapter for just a few minutes, in Romans chapter 1, this letter is directed to all who are in Rome, beloved of God, called to be saints. It is not directed to the church in Rome. It is directed to the Christians in Rome. And again, Rome was a very large city, a large metropolis. When it was burned, there were 14 different districts. So you think about that. I don't know how big a district was, but you know it was a very large city. And so this letter is directed to all of them. And as we're reading here in verse 8 of chapter 1, Paul tells them here for the first time. He says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request if by some means now I at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that you may be established. That is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith, both of you and me. Now I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles. I'm debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to unwise. So as much as is in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also. Paul tells them, acknowledges, I've not been there. Now, were there people there that Paul knew? When you read the list of greetings in the chapter 16, he mentions a number of them by name. There are obviously people he knew. Priscilla and Aquila were among that list, which you know he spent some time with working together in Corinth. But others had not seen him. He had not been there. And so he had to begin, if you will, with that greeting, confirming that he was indeed an apostle. And as Matthew read for us in chapter 15, in verse 22, he says, I also have been much hindered from coming to you, but now no longer having a place in these parts, in Asia, in Achaia, and so on, Macedonia says, and having a great desire these many years to come to you, whenever I journey to Spain, that was his ultimate goal, he says, I shall come to you, for I hope to see you on my way and to be helped on my way by you, if first I may enjoy your company for a while. This was not just spend a week. This was to spend time with them and then go on to Spain. So this is Paul's intention. And you may ask why. Well, Rome was the heart of the empire. In Rome, there were many Jews. in Rome, there were many Christians, and there was a need to encourage them, to teach them. The fact that he says, if I may impart some spiritual gift to you, suggests that maybe that at least some of them had not received them. And so that was part of his intention to be there. But that was what he intended to do. And as Matthew also read in the verses following that, he says, first, I'm going to Judea, and then I will come to you. And history tells us, and the book of Acts ends with Paul's imprisonment in Rome, that that was probably from about AD 62 to 64. We're told in Acts that he dwelt in his own house, hired house, for 2 years, which seems to indicate that he was only there for 2 years. That probably his appeal to Caesar, he had made his case to Caesar, he had been set at liberty and went back. What happened after that, the details, we do not know. But we do know that he was martyred in about AD 65. So not long afterwards. And first in Acts 28, it's clear that what Paul's imprisonment was like. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 particularly, it's apparent that it is not the same. And Paul says, I know that I'm about to die. I know that it's about over. And so Paul always had this intention to go. And I want you to think for a moment. When you think of Rome, what do you think of? First thing, the Colosseum. And I think that's all of us, because that's what we've seen. And it indeed, I'm certain, is amazing. I've not seen it in person, but I think no doubt it is. Some who've been there may think of the Parthenon, another amazing structure that was built there along similar time period. But I want you to realize that religiously, Rome was full of idolatry. And that's all you can say about it. These are the 12 major gods. There were many others, okay? But these are the 12 that were the main ones, the most important ones. They had gods of everything. They had taken most of the Greek gods and then added some more to go with it. And so idolatry, this worship of idols, of the gods, was a very strong part. And you may remember how many times, as we've talked about, for example, in Ephesus, the temple of the great goddess Diana. And there were temples to all the gods in all sorts of places. Every town, every city had at least one temple, often two or three or four. And so idolatry was very much. Now, by the time of the New Testament, and I think this is probably as a unifying force, the Caesars had been recognized as gods. And so they were part of that as well. And so one of the tests for Christians was for them to burn incense to Caesar as a god. And you can imagine what a difficult, well, that was impossible for Christians. So because it was idol worship, it was also, and you saw the picture, and I hope you saw it. I didn't want to spend too much time, because it was what they do in Saturnalia, what they did in their feast called Saturnalia. Saturn being Jupiter, the Greek Jupiter, the god of the greatest of the gods. But you talk about debauchery. You talk about things that should not be seen, much less said. If you have any idea what Mardi Gras is, you're in the right ballpark. Bacchanalia. This was a feast to the god Bacchus, the god of various things, fertility, but chiefly of agriculture and specifically of wine. Why did they choose wine? You know the reason. And that was an excuse to do drink and do everything that you can imagine people would do who were drunk. So was there religion? Well, yes, but not anything close to God. And so that was the religion of the Roman Empire, particularly of Rome, throughout this time period. So you would wonder, how receptive were they to other religions? And indeed, they did accept other religions. They did tolerate them. And there was kind of this understanding, as long as you're willing to, from time to time, make an offering to Caesar, acknowledge Caesar as God, whatever you want to do, that's fine. Now, there were a lot of Jews in Rome. And for a long time, there had been a lot of Jews in Rome. The commercial nature, that's where they were. And on one occasion, this is not the time that's talked about in Acts. This is a time in 19 BC. The emperor exiled all of the Jews out of Rome because they're a plague. They're a pestilence. Now, if you think plague, think of COVID in its fury. That's what he's comparing them to. Because he said, everywhere you go, they're there. So they were tolerated to a certain extent, but they were not looked upon with great joy and honor. And as we notice in Acts chapter 18, and this would have been approximately AD 49. In Acts chapter 18, we're told there of Priscilla and Aquila. And it says, after these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla. Why? Because Claudius, the emperor at that time, had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. And he, Paul, came to them, to live with them. Why were they in Corinth? Why had they left Rome? Because they had been commanded to. And so Judaism was something that I think was, as I say, was tolerated. But the idea, particularly as this time period comes, it becomes a real problem. And Suetonius, who's writing about 50 years less, yeah, about 50, 60 years later, of this time period, says that the reason the Jews had been expelled was that they were making disturbances at the instigation of one Christus. Now, I think you can figure out who Christus is. That's the Latin version of Christ. Were they at the instigation of Christ? No. But you know what the problem was. Because what do we see throughout the book of Acts? From chapter 13 on, every time Paul or anybody goes to a city, preaches in the synagogue, what happens? Before long, a ruckus, and there's a riot, and the Jews are instigating this. Now, you can imagine in Rome where people are coming from everywhere all the time. There are Christians from who knows where that are Jews, of Jewish, you know. And so there would be these things, and every time one of these riots breaks out, the one thing that the Roman Empire, the Roman government, did not tolerate was uprisings, because they were afraid that they were going to become rebellion. And so This was a problem, and it became a problem. And so Judaism, yes, was tolerated, but there were a lot of issues between the two. But now think about Christianity. And in the beginning, it was viewed as a sect of Judaism, and so was suspect. But as it grew and grew and grew, it was recognized as something apart from that. And I think, again, looking here in Acts at chapter 28, Paul is coming there, yes, as a prisoner. As a prisoner who has appealed to Caesar. But notice how he's treated. Verse 16. Now when we came to Rome, the centurion delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard, but Paul was permitted to dwell by himself with a soldier who guarded him. Now, this captain, the centurion, knew why Paul was there for preaching Christ. And yet Paul was not turned over and put in prison, but was rather permitted to live by himself with the soldier who guarded him. And it came to pass after 3 days that Paul called the leaders of the Jews together. So when they come together, he said to them, "Men and brethren, though I've done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans." Now what I want us to particularly notice is 3 days later, and the way they counted time, if Paul had gotten there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that's one day. The next full day would be the second day. The third day, Paul has barely had a time to rest, and yet he calls for the leaders of the Jews to come to him. And they're allowed to. There's none of this, "Oh, no, we don't want a bunch of people here." That's no problem. Paul has the liberty that anybody may come. And so at least there is, at this point, toleration of Christianity. But you may remember, you've no doubt heard of the Christians being tortured. And we're not going to go into all the details of all those things. But it was gruesome. We're going to let one of the historians do that for us. How did this happen? Well, you probably know of the great fire that burned in Rome. And it burned for a number of days, I think 7 days. And I mean, it just burned everything in the path. And of the 14 districts that there were only 4 that were not damaged. Some of them were burned to a crisp, as we would say. Others, because the buildings were out of stone, the ruins were there. They could start over, but there was nothing left. And the rumor went around, apparently, and we'll see the account in just a moment, that Nero, who was the emperor at that time, was accused of setting the fire to clear out space in Rome. You know, what do they call it? Urban renewal. Well, this was going to be urban renewal. But he didn't have the authority to just go in with bulldozers and knock them down. So he set the fire and it burned down so that he could do the plans that he had already planned and were known. And so he chose the Christians as scapegoats. Because you can imagine, if Nero is responsible and he's already acting a little crazy and people are questioning his mental faculties. And so you can imagine if he set the fire that put 3/4 of the citizens of Rome out of a place to live. Now he did give food, he did give assistance and so on after the fact. But you can imagine, he's afraid. He has reason to be afraid. And so as he's searching around for a scapegoat, he chooses the Christians. They're the ones who set the fires. It wasn't me. And so we are told in by various historians that men, women, and even children were tortured. The idea of the lions, they were thrown to the lions. They were crucified. And the picture that I had at the beginning shows it better. But those people in the back there, those are men on crosses. Here are others. They've released one of the lions. There's another one coming up. And we think it's very gruesome, and it is. But this was common. This was just part of Roman culture. Again, they're idolaters. And I want you to read, if we can get there, what Tacitus has to say. And this was written about 117. So yes, it is later. But Tacitus is recognized by everyone to be a pretty reasonable, knowledgeable historian. And I'll read it. I don't know whether you can read it. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abomination, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty. He was crucified during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment by his death, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest, and now you can imagine, you can tell he's not a fan of the Christians. But he goes on to say, accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty and admitted they were Christians. Then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city, but of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt, to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his garden for the spectacle. It was exhibiting a show in the circus in both places, while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or stood aloft on a car. Hence, even for criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion. For it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty, that they were being destroyed. So you can imagine from the details that are there what it must have been like. And yet, Christians stood in the face of this. What was Rome's ultimate, and this is the beginning of persecution, and it went on, off and on up until about 312. When Constantine, who was proclaimed emperor, proclaimed it a legitimate, a lawful religion. And that wasn't that was the end of official persecution, but it didn't end in many places. And so Rome, as the heart of the empire, was corrupt. And you know that that came out. And so I want you to think for just a moment, as we're getting toward the end, to think about how Christians responded to persecutions. And you know, and I know, we know people. There were some who were willing to deny Christ completely, to turn their back on him, to offer the sacrifice, to offer the incense, to say Caesar is a god, and they never thought again about Christ because it was too dangerous. The cost was too high. And the number, we don't know, but you know there were people. I suspect there were others who, as I put it, did what they had to do. They were Christians. They were put in the position, if you don't worship Caesar, we're going to kill you. And so in their mind, they're thinking, okay, I'm going to do this because this is what I've got to do to save my life. But I still believe in Christ. I'm going to serve him, but you know, I have to sin, and God forgive me of this. Now, we all sinned. And you can imagine, if you're there with your family, your wife, your children, and whoever's the Roman official says, if you don't worship Caesar, I'm going to kill you, and all your family are going to be tortured. You talk about pressure. And it's not right, and I'm not suggesting that it is. But you understand why they would do that. And so, as many people throughout the centuries have compromised. Well, I know this is what God says, but in this one point, I'm going to deviate a little bit. But then there were those that were willing to die for Christ and the truth. And you can imagine, again, that same pressure was on them. You can imagine husbands concerned, thinking about my wife. And yet they both were martyred. If there were children, even more so. But the parents, knowing that the children are innocent, know where they're going to be. And I think that's something that we Christians in this country may never face. Abandon Christ, deny Christ, or be killed. But the persecution we already know is beginning. But these Christians were willing to stand for that. In Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 21, they're beginning at verse 8. This is when Paul is coming to Jerusalem for what we know will be the last time, and then he'll go from there to Rome. And they, as they're coming on their journey, we have all the places they stopped. In verse 4, just notice, and finding disciples, we stayed there 7 days. This was at Tyre. They told Paul through the Spirit not to go up to Jerusalem. So they went on their way. In verse 8, it says, on the next day, we who were Paul's companions departed, came to Caesarea, and entered the house of Philip the evangelist, who was one of the seven, and stayed with him. Now this man had 4 virgin daughters who prophesied. And as we stayed many days, a certain prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. When he had come to us, he took Paul's belt, bound his own hands and feet, and said, thus says the Holy Spirit, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. Now he said, now when we heard this, both we and those from that place pleaded with him not to go up to Jerusalem. And I mean, in chapter 20, Paul tells the Ephesian elders, I have been warned what awaits me in Jerusalem, but I'm going. Notice Paul's answer. Then Paul answered and said, what do you mean by weeping and breaking my heart? For I'm ready not only to be bound, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. So when he would not be persuaded, we ceased saying, the will of the Lord be done. Paul knew. And this was not some premonition. This was not some, you know, things are not looking good. This was, he had been told on numerous occasions, you're going to be bound in Jerusalem. You're going to be given into the hands of the Gentiles. Did he know where he was going to die? No, he didn't. Did he he thought it was a real possibility that he would die. And he was willing to go in spite of all that. And I want to close. And this was something that happened in the 90s. Just to tell us who Polycarp is. Polycarp is likely one of the last disciples of one of the apostles. So that's a long time removed. History says that he was a disciple of John. He was a leader, probably an elder, in the church in Smyrna. And when it came to the point that he was before the proconsul, when the proconsul saw him, he realized this is an old man. This is a man 86 years old. How many years does he have left? Not many. And so he beseeches, he begs him, just curse Jesus. Offer the incense and you'll save your life. The few years you have left, you can live in joy and happiness. And he said, no, I can't do that. I can't deny him. And the proconsul didn't give up. And he, again, just kind of went on. Finally, he said, swear and reproach Christ and I will set you free. And Polycarp's response was, 86 years have I served him, and he has done me no wrong. How could I blaspheme my King and my Savior? What faith. And brethren, certainly, do I know? Do you know what you would be with if faced with that? We think that we would be strong. But I don't know. But I think we have, and I'm persuaded the reason this has been preserved through the centuries is as an example to us what our faith should be. We should be willing to say, I have served Christ how long? And of course, that's going to vary from person to person. He has never done me any wrong, which we know. And he says, so how can I blaspheme my King and my God? May that always be our faith. And our resolve to know that after this life, there is another. No matter how long or how short we live here, there is another life. That which is called in 1 Timothy chapter 6, that which is life indeed. That which is real.